everybody. Welcome to Senate Finance. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. Today is Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. The time is 9:03 a.m. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning.
And Senator Olson is excused from the call of the Senate Finance today. I'd like to turn the gavel over to Senator Giesel.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I will introduce my Senate members. Present today are Senator Meyer, Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator Wilikowski may be joining us later. Thank you.
On today's agenda, we have the World Energy Outlook by Mr. Mark Finley, General Manager of Global Energy Market, BP America. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? I would like to advise those at home online or off net that you can access the documents being presented today under Senate Finance, the Alaska Legislature. The title of the presentation is BP Energy Outlook 2018 edition. Mark Finley, General Manager. Mr. Finley, our technology is going up and down, so if you could refer to the actual slide during the presentation in case the visual goes down, that those following at home can move along with the presentation with us. Sure. Your name for the record. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Good morning, Senators McKinnon and Giesel, and honorable members of the committees. My name is Mark Finley. I'm the General Manager of Global Energy Markets and U.S. Economics for BP. By way of background, I'm an energy economist by both profession and training, and have spent 35 years in both the public and private sectors studying the kind of intersection of energy, economics, and geopolitics. I'd like to thank you all for taking time today and for inviting BP to share its long-term outlook with you all. If I may, thank you all for your service to the state of Alaska. This is my first time in Juneau. I've been coming to Alaska for more than 15 years with BP, but have never made it into the southeast part of the state. So I look forward to the conversation. And that's actually an important part of it. By way of background, the long-term outlook that forms the background for the presentation that we have today is something that BP uses to inform its own strategic thinking about the future and our portfolio and investments across the energy space. And the obvious question that comes out is, we do all of this work to inform our own thinking, why share it externally? And there's two reasons. The first is we feel it's important to be part of the conversation in the world of energy and the energy transition that we see that the world is in. And we think that, we hope, and you can tell me when we're done today, that our perspectives can add to that conversation. But as an analyst who's a member of the team that produces the outlook, there's another reason, which is to avoid groupthink. We can expose our ideas to as many different brains as possible around the world because, let's face it, these are hard, complicated issues, and no one has a crystal ball. And the more constructive conversation and, frankly, criticism that we can get for our work, the better we all are for it. And so I very much welcome your feedback and challenge as we go through this presentation. Just in terms of mechanics, please jump in anytime with questions. There is a formal presentation that I'll be working through, but I don't know about you. If I have to hold my question to the end, I usually forget it. And since this is for your benefit, let's not do that. Please jump in. The way we do approach this outlook process is with a spirit of humility. We're trying to look out, in this case, to at least 2040. 25 years is a long time, and this is a very complicated and uncertain space. And we think that we do ourselves and the people with whom we speak a disservice if we try to be too conclusive about it. This is not about predicting the future. It is about understanding the uncertainty that the world's energy system faces. What dimensions of it do we have some confidence in? What dimensions of it are massively uncertain and could put the world's in very different outcomes depending on how key variables break out? And so as I move to the second slide in the pack, the way we approach this is not to try to give you a single forecast, but rather to deliver a range of scenarios as a way to illustrate the key uncertainties and the shape of uncertainty around the world's energy system. On the left-hand panel of this chart, I'm showing you different profiles for the demand for energy. And by the way, I will use phrases like demand and consumption interchangeably, and similarly supply and production. The units on this chart, by the way, if you look on the left-hand side, are TOE, tons of oil equivalent. So one of the key questions that we energy analysts face is, how do you compare solar energy to coal? We do it on the basis of energy content. So we take the amount of energy in each of these various forms of energy, convert them into the equivalent of the energy content of a ton of oil, about 7 barrels, so that we can make like-for-like comparisons between different forms of energy. You see a range of scenarios presented on these two panels. For the purposes of telling a story, we will build much of the presentation around the scenario that's labeled here as ET. It's not an outer space scenario. It stands for evolving transition. In other words, this is a scenario that's consistent with the continued evolution of the energy system, of policies, of technology, in a manner consistent with what we've seen in terms of the rate of change over the last 20 to 25 years. We further will use a variety of lenses for looking at these challenges. So I'm now on slide 3 for people who are joining in. Here I'm showing you the same picture repeated 3 times, but sliced different ways for perspective. And what I'm showing you is the energy demand profile, if you go all the way back to 1970 and looking forward to 2040, so spanning 70 years. And then on the left-hand panel, we slice it by sector of the economy. In the center panel, we slice it by part of the world. And on the right-hand side, we slice it by fuel. And as we will see as we go through the presentation, yeah, there's different insights you can learn about the progress and changes in the energy system by looking through these various lenses. Much of the analysis is driven by the first panel, the sectoral, because let's face it, at the end of the day, we don't consume as individuals and as companies, we don't consume oil, gas, or coal. We consume space heating or mobility. And so a lot of the underlying economic drivers of the consumption of energy come from a sectoral lens, and we'll see lots of examples of that as we go through the presentation. What I'd like to do first is focus on some of those other lenses. So I'm now on slide 4 in the panel. Here I'm showing you the breakdown of energy demand in the narrative scenario that we're using for regions of the world. The U.S. is in the green bar. It's part of a group of countries called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's basically the club of mature market economies in North America, Western Europe, and Japan. You can see that there is no growth of energy demand in the U.S. and in the other mature developed economies of the world in this scenario. One of the key drivers of that is a greater focus on the more efficient use of energy. And that's a common theme around the world or in this scenario. In fact, this scenario projects that the growth of energy demand will slow significantly over time. All of the net growth will be in the emerging economies. But even as behind the scenes, one of the things that motivates the development of our scenarios is a view of, can the world have the energy it needs to continue to grow and to lift people out of poverty and improve people's quality of life? That is taken as a given in all of the scenarios that we're going to present with you today. And on the right-hand side, you can see on a regional basis, where does the growth come from? And the answer is the emerging economies, in particular, India and China. I'm sorry, Senator, was there a question?
Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's interesting, without even having a population escalator for 40 years in OECD, considering the variation in countries in that category, that seems unrealistically flat.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that I should respond by saying through the chair, Senator. It's an entirely fair challenge, and again, at the end of the day, we need to be humble and acknowledge that this is just one scenario, and there are lots of different possible outcomes. As you can see on this chart, the recent historical data does actually show relatively flat consumption of energy since about the year 2000 for the countries in green, including the United States. So that certainly includes the Great Recession, but it also includes periods of economic growth before and after it. And I think that there is some evidence emerging that the historical relationship between growing economies and growing energy demand, especially in these more mature economies, is changing. Mm-hmm. You know, partly it's an efficiency story, partly it's you know, the growing concentration of services, you know, and less heavy industry as a share of economic activity. But, you know, it's certainly a fair challenge that I believe that there is, and we'll see as we go through the presentation, certainly places where there are upside risks for the demand profile.
Senator Bishop.
Just real briefly, thank you, Madam Chair. Dovetail on Senator Machicki's question. So on your, I don't know what you use for your data sets for building your slides, but on the, just for the U.S. example, in the green, are you factoring in population growth? Mm. Okay, so that could, the United States population is flat or starting to go the other way. Thank you.
Right. And so Senator Bishop, is it? Senator Bishop, through the chair, Senator Bishop. We do factor in expectations of population growth, and you're right, most of that population growth is in the emerging economies. You know, personally, as an analyst, one of the good news, we're only looking out 25 years. The working age population in 2040 has basically been born already. And so absent, you know, some kind of global pandemic, much of the working age population for 2040 has already been born. And so that's, I think we have a relative reasonable degree of comfort about that. Now, behind the scenes, it's not just the population, but the per capita income and the urbanization of the population that matters. And so in the main outlook document, which we have copies of for you today, you know, for example, we'll explore different prospects for African energy demand driven by different assumptions around the rates of industrialization and the urbanization of the population. Because, as you know, the population, the profile for how you consume energy is very different if you're in a city or in the country. And so behind this outlook are very specific views on not only population growth, but urbanization as well as economic growth.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Finley. Please continue.
All right. Madam Chair, thank you very much. On the right-hand side of this panel, what I'm showing you is annual average growth rates broken out into 10-year periods. And you can see that the in this narrative scenario, the growth of energy demand slows significantly. And moreover, you can see where that slowdown takes place, the blue. Chinese energy consumption has been the big driver of the world's energy demand over the last 20 years as China has embarked on a very rapid period of economic growth and industrialization that has been very energy intensive. That's already changing. You know, economic growth in China has slowed. It still remains robust, but not growing at 10% a year. And also, the mode of development is changing. You know, away from heavy industry and toward more of a focus on domestic consumption of goods and services. Moreover, many of you who have traveled to China would know, you know, the local air pollution problems, and you see that there's a big push inside China to use energy more efficiently, as well as to shift the profile of energy consumed within China. Taking all of those factors into account, what emerges in this scenario is that India actually replaces China as the biggest source of growing energy demand in the later years of the outlook. But overall, global energy demand grows much more slowly than has been the case historically, even with continued economic growth. The next lens, and in the interest of time, I'm going to skip to slide number 6 in your pack, is to look at energy demand by form of energy or by fuel. And what I'd like to do is focus on the right-hand side, which shows you the market shares for the different forms of energy. So you can see on the right-hand side, the orange line at the bottom doesn't stay at the bottom for very long. Renewable forms of energy today are a very small share of the world's energy mix, but by far the fastest growing group of fuels. This is primarily wind and solar in power generation, but also biofuels in transportation, as well as smaller quantities of geothermal energy and other renewable forms of energy. As you can see on the right-hand side, by far the fastest growing group of fuels, it rises to almost 15% of the world's energy by 2040 in this scenario. And the growth of renewables accounts for about 40% of the growth of total energy consumption in the world in this scenario. The other growth story is the red line, which is natural gas, which in this scenario is the only fossil energy type that gains global market share. Global consumption of coal, in absolute terms, is roughly flat, with big declines in the United States, Europe, and China, offset by increases in India and other emerging economies. But in terms of market share, coal drops significantly, and this represents the biggest change in the outlook relative to the experience of the last 20 years. If you look at that chart on the right, you can see in the last 20 years, the gray line was going up. You know, coal was gaining global market share on the back of China's rapid economic development in particular. One of the interesting observations that we can draw from this chart, if we extend the history and combine all of the non-fossil forms of energy into a single category, and I'm now on slide 7 for people joining in, this shows you the very long-term evolution of the different forms of energy that the world's economy uses. And a couple points. First, in this scenario, the world ceases to have a single dominant source of energy, which has never been the case before. Moreover, you can see that the world's mix of fuels becomes much more diverse than has ever been the case before. And it's a nice picture, but I think it also highlights one of the key points that comes out of our work in the Energy Outlook, which is that we believe the world is trending in a direction of becoming much more competitive in the energy space. First, as we've seen already, the projected growth of energy demand is likely to slow, so the pie isn't getting as big as quickly as it used to. Secondly, as we see here, there's a much more diverse fuel mix and much more opportunities for fuels to compete against each other. And we'll see an example of that shortly in transportation with electrification. And then finally, there's also, we believe, growing prospects for competition between different suppliers to meet this demand. And we'll see very specific examples of that when we come to our discussions of oil and natural gas. You know, but at a high level, for the purposes of this discussion, I think for us one of the key takeaways is that we believe the world of energy is likely to become even more competitive over time.
Senator Mendenhall.
Thank you. I would like to just go back one slide just to number 6 previously. On the left-hand side there, I just want to make sure that I'm reading this correctly. While the percentage of the share of oil, gas, coal, et cetera, goes down, the absolute consumption of oil and coal still is high because overall consumption is going up. So what I want to make sure is that, I don't want people to read this. They say, hydro and renewables are going to overtake it. They're not. Mm. There still is a big demand for coal and oil.
Senator Van Inhofe through the chair. That's a very fair observation. And in fact, as we will see going through the presentation, one of the key takeaways that we will have is that while we do believe that renewable energy is likely to gain significant market share, as you can see, this is still a world where the world continues to, you know, consume significant quantities of fossil fuels. And you are absolutely right to observe that falling market share is compatible with rising consumption, for example, in the case of oil. The absolute level of oil consumption will continue to grow, but it doesn't grow as rapidly as the total energy complex, and so its share will decline. And that's a very fair observation.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do next, and I'm moving now to slide number 8 for people following along, is having given a brief overview of our outlook process and some of the key findings from the narrative scenario, is to begin with a dig deeper into some key questions that we are wrestling with, and I would imagine that the people in this room and the people you represent have a similar list of questions on their minds when they think about the future of energy. And so we'd like to begin with a focus on electric cars. And I'm now on slide number 9, which simply highlights the first question. We certainly find as we travel around the world that the question about electrification and more broadly the transformation of the transportation sector you know, is a critical issue on everyone's mind, and it's massively uncertain. And to be fair, the wording of this question is very specific. You know, what have we learned, you know, parenthesis, so far about this? And what have we learned not only about electric cars, but more broadly the mobility revolution? And as we get into the discussion, you'll see that we believe that by itself, electrification is unlikely to be the game changer. But if you combine electrification with other factors in the mobility revolution, in a particular autonomy and ride sharing, then these act as force multipliers that can have result in much bigger implications for oil demand and for the energy system. So there's almost a parlor game in the energy circles of saying, well, how many electric cars do you have in your forecast? And I'll tell you, we have 300 million electric cars by 2040 in a global car fleet of 2 billion cars. But that's the wrong measure. You know, in our view, it's not how many cars, it's how they get driven that matters. And so what I'm showing you on this chart, with apologies to acknowledge that this chart was prepared in London and so it's in kilometers instead of miles, what I'm showing you here is the projections of miles driven and what share of miles driven will be met by electric cars in this narrative scenario. And on the left-hand panel, it's 30%. As you can see. So roughly speaking, on behind the scenes, what's happening is that the global car fleet doubles. There's about a billion cars on the road today, and we have that growing to about 2 billion cars, with most of that growth in the rapidly growing emerging economies. And we have the amount of miles traveled met by electric cars is about 30%. Now, remember, I just told you that we have 300 million cars out of 2 billion that are electric. You know, and doing the math, you'll say, well, that's 15%. How does that consistent with 30% of the miles driven? And the answer, obviously, is we believe in this scenario the electric cars will be driven more miles. And why is that? It's shown on the right-hand panel. It's autonomy that's the driver. So we believe that autonomous cars are likely to become commercially available at scale in the mid-2020s and that they will grow rapidly. But at first, they're likely to be relatively expensive. Expensive to buy, but not expensive to operate, and that's a key difference. We know that many of the ride-sharing services are really big on autonomous cars because it turns out that the driver is 40 to 50% of the cost of operating the vehicle. So if you're going to pay more up front for a car that's autonomous, you can make the economics work if you operate it more miles because it's cheaper per mile. So the logic is that, at least as at first, as autonomous cars ramp up, they will primarily be used in these ride-sharing and fleet services. By the way, that same logic, expensive up front but cheaper to operate, also applies to electric cars. So we believe that electric cars are likely to form the majority of those autonomous cars as they work their way into the fleet. And so the result is that while you only have 15% of the cars being electric, they drive 30% of the miles because they're primarily used in these autonomous fleet applications.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you update us on how the autonomous cars work? How do they detect the road and determine speed?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm afraid that that's a degree of expertise on autonomy that is beyond me. I would, however, like to use your question to flag that there is a companion piece of work that BP has just published last week called the Technology Outlook, that reviews in much more detail, BP's internal research and our understanding of the underpinning technological issues around not only autonomy but a wide spectrum of applications within the energy space. And so I'm sorry that I don't have that expertise to handle it directly, but hopefully we can get some resources for you.
Thank you.
If we might, Senator Steadman, you're our transportation chairman, if you might research into some of that and sometime in the future, if not this year, then next, provide the legislature with additional information on that. I'm not sure if I'm dovetailing or in line with Senator Giesel, but Alaska's conditions are very different than other areas. And I know that my car, where I keep on all of the standardized bells and whistles that alarm if I am crossing a line or if there's somebody in the car's perimeter that it is warning me about, sometimes it pushes the brakes automatically in ice road conditions when it's looking at how the road has been graded and whether the road actually has a white line that's next to it on snow, that it does not recognize the difference between a white line and crossing another lane. And so it becomes dangerous, specifically in icy conditions, that it tries to put on the brakes when I'm trying to maintain a speed if I'm going up a hill or a crossing if I'm trying to make myself safe inside the car. Senator Giesel, do you have any comments on your concerns or question?
Well, I would just add, Madam Chair, that we have a lot of dirt roads, of course, in Alaska, unpaved roads, and right. So that creates a challenge also. So just interested in how this technology is actually applied. Thank you.
No, and it's a fair question, and again, in the spirit of being humble and acknowledging the uncertainty, I think one of the things that we can observe is that as we think about risks in the outlook, it certainly seems in the public narrative that the direction of risks when you're talking about the number of electric cars is only one way. You know, everyone says, no matter what number you give, people say, oh, that's not big enough. Yeah, that's exactly what you'd expect a big oil company to say. In fact, I have some slides coming up on that. But on autonomy, I mean, that introduces a dimension of risk that is actually can go either way. And in fact, if you think about it, we're saying that autonomous cars are beginning to come into the fleet by the mid-2020s. It could easily be 10 years later if the issues that you flag rightly, can't be, adequately addressed. But it's unlikely that it's going to be 10 years earlier because that's today. and so one of the things that we like about the framework here is that it allows us to bring in risks on both sides of the outlook and bring some balance to the conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. Please continue.
So I'm now on slide 11 for people joining in, and what this chart is trying to show you is the implications of this scenario for oil demand by cars. And the way to read the chart is we start at the left-hand side, how much oil is consumed today, about 19 million barrels per day, or about 20% of all of the oil consumed in the world is consumed in cars in the form of gasoline and diesel fuel. If you go successively from left to right on the chart, in the green bar, if you, roughly speaking, double the amount of cars on the road and nothing else changes, you would double the amount of oil consumed by cars. But there are things that are changing. And in this scenario, the main thing that changes is the yellow and red area. It's fuel efficiency standards. There have certainly been headlines on this coming out of Washington, D.C. this week, but it's important to note that this is a global scenario, and we do see very aggressive tightening of fuel efficiency standards in China, in India, in Europe. In this scenario, the significant improvement in the average fuel efficiency of a car completely offsets the doubling of the car fleet. If we then add in the blue bar of, an additional reduction of oil demand because these electric cars are being used in fleet services and driven more intensively, we come out with a view that in this scenario, oil demand by cars in 2040 is exactly what it is today, even though the number of cars on the road doubles. Now, you'll also notice on this chart that electric vehicles appear twice on the chart, once in the blue and once in the red. The important point for the red is that it is part of a combination of factors that auto companies can use to meet their corporate average fuel efficiency standards. The way regulations are written, not only here in the United States but around the world, is to say not every car has to get more efficient, but the average of the fleet of cars that a maker sells have to get more efficient. They can meet that by making all the cars more efficient, or they can make it by selling a higher number of smaller cars, or they can meet it by selling electric vehicles. The key point here is that the regulation defines the size of the box. And in that sense, again, based on the way regulations are written today, the number of electric cars is irrelevant for oil demand. Because think of it this way. If the regulation defines the size of that box, if you sell more electric cars, it creates space for the automaker to sell more bigger cars instead, while still meeting their average target. Now, the next challenge is, of course, as I mentioned earlier, to the chair's question, of course, an oil company would say that electric cars aren't having that big of an impact. So we developed a different scenario that says, let's go ahead and ban the sale of the internal combustion engine in cars by 2040 worldwide. And by the way, to make the scenario even more rigorous, we're not even allowing plug-in hybrids that would offer a combination of an internal combustion engine and a battery. So in this scenario, the only thing you are allowed to sell by 2040 is an electric car. And we, moreover, to be true to the spirit of the challenge, we also made them ramp up very early in the process. So you can see on the left-hand panel of slide 12 that the green line diverges from the blue line very early in the forecast. We're trying to front-load the sale of these electric cars as much as possible. The result of that is that on the right-hand side, you can see that by 2040, compared to our narrative scenario, which will have about a third of the miles driven powered by electric cars, in this scenario, where we ban the sale of the internal combustion engine, two-thirds of the miles driven is powered by battery cars. And you may be asking, well, why not 100? If we're banning the sale of the internal combustion engine. And the answer is, who here buys a car every year? I know I don't. while we ban the sale by 2040, there will still be legacy internal combustion engine cars on the road that will account for that remaining one-third of miles driven. Now, what this means for oil demand is shown here. On slide 13, if we ban the sale of the internal combustion engine, we cut oil demand by cars by more than half. It reduces it by about 10 million barrels a day relative to the narrative scenario in blue that we've been talking about. But here's the thing. As we will see shortly, this is only applying this to 20% of the world's oil demand. It's only to cars. But there's still growing demand for trucking, for aviation, for maritime, and for shipping, and for industrial applications. So, as we'll see shortly, overall oil demand is growing behind the scenes in this scenario, and even if we ban the sale of the internal combustion engine, oil demand in 2040 is higher than it is today because of growth in other parts of the complex.
Senator von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I do see that this particular slide, the one previously in 12, when you talked about the potential scenario if there was an internal combustion engine ban, and then I'm looking ahead, and I do know that in slide 23 you will be addressing the renewables. I'm just curious throughout your narrative if you may want to just touch upon these economic assumptions, of course, are not without their political effects. So a significant factor in economic growth, of course, is political influences. And the question that I have is that with electric cars, renewable energy, you have secondary effects such as the need for copper, the need for lithium, the need for zinc for the batteries. There are a growing anti-development, anti-mines, environmental obstructionist, and NIMBY attitudes of I don't want to I don't want a dam in my neighborhood. I don't want a bunch of windmills marring my landscape. So on one hand, there is a desire by Americans, at least, to see renewable resources. But on the other hand, they don't like the discomfort that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. So I'll be very curious if your team has analyzed the push-pull that will certainly happen in the next 30 years regarding renewables.
Senator von Imhoff, through the chair, that's a very fair challenge. And behind the scenes in the narrative scenario that we've built, we actually do include, we make space for public opposition and permitting delays to impact. Now, we're economists, and so we translate everything into cost, because it's the way we build our models. So, what we do is make a provision for, in certain locales, you know, projects to get delayed or for extra cost to be added into the project. And you know, as over time, it, as if costs accumulate to a point where a given project is not competitive, then it doesn't work because our model runs everything off of, you know, kind of costs and competition. So we try to make provisions for that in a qualitative way, but haven't explicitly modeled an alternative scenario that, you know, digs more deeply into that.
Please continue.
All right, thank you. On the right-hand panel of slide 13, what we're showing you is, let's think about what are the implications of banning the internal combustion engine for global CO2 emissions. So at first, what I'm showing you doesn't include this scenario. I'm showing you the blue line is CO2 emissions from energy in the narrative scenario. And just for reference, the orange represents a scenario that is consistent with global commitments to the Paris Climate Accords. And if we do the CO2 implications of the green bar on the left of banning the internal combustion engine, what does it do to global CO2 emissions? On slide 14, the answer is you almost can't even see the impact. And the reason for that is simple, because you're only attacking one piece of one fuel. You know, you're only going after oil demand in cars. And what it highlights is a theme that we will come back to as we go through the presentation, which is, you know, if you're concerned to the degree to which you're concerned about a global problem, like climate change, a global comprehensive solution to the, you know, across the whole energy system is what's needed. That policy options that just push on a single lever, like banning the internal combustion engine, is unlikely to move the needle at a global scale due to the size and complexity of the energy system around the world. The next question on slide 15 is another bit of the parlor game of energy watchers around the world, which is, well, when is oil demand going to peak? This is actually an interesting shift in mindset. You know, for most of the history of the world's oil industry, people have worried about running out of supply. You know, through innovations like shale, you know, and simple economics, you know, we at BP believe that, you know, the more likely driver of change is to be at some point a potential peak in demand. You know, as you think about the transformation of the transportation system, climate policies, et cetera, and that's a significant change in mindset. On the supply side, we refer to, you know, in this scenario, more likely to see an emerging age of abundance for oil and gas, and we'll come back to that. But, you know, what it's interesting to me as someone who's been watching this space for 35 years to see how it has evolved from are we going to run out of supply to are we going to run out of demand? So first, the base data. Again, in our narrative scenario on slide 16, I'm showing you the profile for global oil demand, and you can see that it grows, but it begins to slow down over time. And indeed, if we look at the right-hand side where I show you growth increments, you can see that today we're seeing very strong growth in global oil demand due to a combination of a strong synchronized global economic recovery and consumers reacting to the recent price collapse over the last few years. As we go through time, you can see that that growth of oil demand slows significantly. And, in fact, you can see what happens. The blue area goes away. As we've discussed, oil demand and transportation ceases to grow, largely driven by fuel efficiency gains in this scenario. One thing to point out is that if you look at the net, you can see that it does begin to decline slightly after 2035, but to my mind, if you look at the scale, that's a very small number. In fact, the total decline in worldwide oil consumption over the last 5 years of this outlook is about 1 million barrels per day. In other words, half of the growth we saw last year alone. So not a big change. We're referring to this more of a plateau than a peak. You can also see the gray area remains a positive contributor. You know, what's labeled here as non-combusted uses is largely petrochemical feedstocks. again, the non-combustive is important because it means that that portion of oil demand can continue to grow, but because it doesn't get burned, it doesn't add CO2 emissions to the atmosphere. And what we find is that these basic, you know, petrochemicals, as you know, are a basic building block of modern economies. And if you're going to keep growing the world's economy, you need to keep growing the petrochemicals. There aren't many substitutes available. Scope for efficiency is relatively limited, although we have made a provision for policies around the world that seek to reduce the use of single-use plastics, like, you know, the water bottles that we use. So we've made a provision that tries to increase the recycling of that, and the result is that we've reduced oil demand by about 2 million barrels a day just because of greater recycling of plastics. But even with that, you know, again, in the spirit of humility, I'm now on slide 17. That's just one view of future oil demand. And there are lots of different potential cases. What I'm showing you here are a range of different outcomes. The blue line at the top is our narrative scenario. You can see also the profile for oil demand under the light green, which is the scenario where we ban the internal combustion engine. Also, the orange line, which once again is a scenario that's consistent with meeting the Paris obligations. Now, there are also upside risks, of course, to the outlook. For example, if fuel efficiency doesn't gain as quickly as we're projecting, you could easily see oil demand, in response to the senator's earlier question, you could easily see oil demand that is much higher than this as well. But the key question is, look, you know, on the orange line, even in a scenario that is consistent with meeting the Paris obligations, the world will be consuming 85 million barrels a day of oil in 2040, compared to about 95 to 100 today. But if we think about one other dimension, I'm now on slide 18, and I will say this particular slide has been profoundly impactful in informing BP's thinking. What we're doing here is saying, well, what if we don't invest in new production? You know, if we think oil demand is going to peak and begin to decline, why would people invest in future production? As you know, an individual well tends to decline, have its production decline over time. So what we've done is take the current base of production and just applied a 3% annual decline to it. Our oil producers, you know, my operators would say that's a very conservative number. It would likely be even higher. But we don't need it to be higher to make our point, I mean, a higher decline rate, that is. We don't need it to make our point, which is mind the gap. If you look under any imaginable future scenario for oil demand, the world will need to continue to invest significant amounts in producing new supply to meet it due to the phenomenon of the underlying decline of the existing production. Now, that doesn't mean we can afford to relax and take things for granted, because as we will see shortly, we think that there's going to be a lot of competition to meet that supply. But, you know, within BP, you may have heard our executives talk about, and when we talk about our strategy, you know, one of the elements of it is we will continue to invest in oil, advantaged oil that, you know, is competitive, but there is a need to continue to invest in oil. And so where does the supply come from to meet this demand profile? At a stylized level, in our evolving transition scenario, our narrative scenario, it's half the United States and half OPEC. That in the U.S., growing shale production, especially in the early years of the forecast, as shown on the left-hand side of slide 19. This, by the way, this profile is consistent with what we're seeing in the oil patch today, which is, you know, a rig count around 600 on the right-hand side, an industry that is promising to exercise financial discipline, characterized by potential bottlenecks in the availability of pipeline and access and, you know, skilled crews, et cetera. So this is a scenario that is built around the kind of cautious view that we see the lower 48 independent operators taking today. But again, as with everything, there are uncertainties. For U.S. shale, we've identified and examined a couple. One is, what if the resource doesn't change, but the pace at which that resource is developed accelerates? And the second is, well, what if the resource is even bigger than we think? So if I skip ahead to slide 21, I show you the outcomes of both of those scenarios as well. You know, so first the green line. This is a scenario in which the underlying resource doesn't change relative to our narrative scenario, but it gets developed much more aggressively. You know, if the industry's ability to finance its operations suddenly becomes more, you know, easier, you know, if the industry abandons this financial discipline and goes back to drilling more aggressively, you could easily see production accelerate, but because the resource isn't any bigger, it declines more rapidly on the back end.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you for your presentation. It's very enlightening. A slide or two back, you mentioned something about BP will continue to invest in advantaged oil. How do you define advantaged oil?
So Senator Meyer, through the chair, thank you for your question. It's simple in concept. You know, is it competitive? Can it make money? And so, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, for much of the history of our industry, you know, there were people who thought this is a scarce resource and we're going to run out and we just need to, wherever there's resource, we need to access it. You know, we believe that's not the right framework for thinking about the future. You know, in a world where we think the resource is abundant, you know, in our a companion piece of work, we track the BP annual statistical review of world energy. We track proved reserves of oil and gas. In 1980, or since 1980, when we began to track proved reserves, the world has cumulatively produced more oil than it had. And manifestly, the world has not run out of oil. In fact, proved reserves today are double what they were in 1980. So for 35 years running, the world has actually discovered 2 barrels for every oil barrel that has been produced. And so, you know, we don't believe that the world is fundamentally constrained in the resource. And as a result, you know, the obligation we have to our shareholders is not to access a resource at any cost, but rather to invest in projects that are competitive and can earn, you know, a competitive rate of return.
So, Madam Chair, if I may. Is Alaska considered advantaged oil?
Pardon me, Senator, and through the chair. I'm not an expert in Alaska. I mean, it's certainly a world-class province, and I can observe based on official data that oil production in the state has actually increased for the last 2 years in a row. And in fact, according to the U.S. Energy Department's data, which I believe is based on official state data, that hasn't happened since 1987-88, you know, to see 2 years in a row of growing oil production. So I think, you know, the answer to your question is, the answer will be, it depends. It depends on, you know, how the people in this room are able to, you know, and the people you represent are able to work with industry to deliver projects that can compete in a global supply curve. And again, not my area of expertise to opine on the specifics of the situation here, but merely to note that in a global context, I mean, that's the way a company like ours would think about it.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I appreciate that answer, and I know I'm putting you in a spot here a little bit, but you know, from a state legislator's perspective, obviously we're very concerned that. Since oil is so important to our economy up here, that we maintain or have an advantaged, if I may use your term, advantaged oil. And it concerns me with the growing demand and production of the shale oil, especially in Lower 48, that, you know, can Alaska continue to compete? So thank you.
And Senator, through the chair, I think that that's it's an entirely fair observation. And in fact, I think I would point out, I don't have slides on it in this presentation, but we've done some work separately that's available on our website, and we can share with you if you're interested. That we believe that the combination of supply and demand factors that we think are playing out in the oil market are changing the strategic calculus of a number of key oil producers around the world. And what we can observe, for example, is that, many key Middle East oil producers, for example, have embarked on programs of very aggressive, at least in aspiration, very aggressive economic reforms to reform their economies, to reduce their dependence on oil revenues, and to position themselves to compete in this, in what we think is likely to be a much more competitive oil and energy space going down the road. And so I, what you're wrestling with, I see evidence that, you know, a lot of you know, holders of large natural resources are similarly wrestling with and trying to understand, you know, how to position themselves to be competitive in that new reality.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. And please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So returning to slide 21, just very briefly, we've talked about the scenario for if U.S. shale gets delivered more aggressively. On the other hand, if it's simply a matter that the resource turns out to be bigger than we currently appreciate, the red line shows you that U.S. by itself could meet all of the projected growth in global oil demand over this outlook. And with obviously significant ramifications for the rest of the marketplace. One of the interesting observations for us is that if you look at the green and red lines on the left-hand panel of the chart, they look very similar in the early years of the forecast. And so if we were to see, for example, rapid growth of U.S. production, the question is, well, is that because the resource is bigger or simply because the resource is being exploited more quickly and likely to decline? And, you know, the answer is, you'd have to look behind, you know, kind of lift up, the cover to look beneath the surface to understand what the drivers of that are, because as you can see, the longer term ramifications of those two different pathways are profoundly impactful for the oil market outlook. The next question, and I promise that these last several questions will move more quickly. By the way, Madam Chair, do you have a hard stop in mind? I don't want to take advantage of your time.
10:30 is a hard stop.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you very much. So the next question is, you know, about renewable energy, and we've already had some questions from the honorable senators on this today. Boy, if you want to be humble when it comes to being an energy market analyst, let's talk about renewable energy. You know, we have an appendix in our main document that shows you that we've been revising our forecast up for renewables every year. And this year is no exception. We've revised our outlook higher. So one of the questions is, well, what have you learned? And as we've studied it, what we find is we wind up revising our forecast higher for India and China, not for the world as a whole. So if it was simply the case that renewables were more competitive for everyone, we would expect that we'd be revising our forecast higher for everyone. The fact that the revisions are concentrated in India and China suggests to us that it's something else at play. And what we believe is we've always built our outlook around the assumption that government support for renewables will be reduced over time, you know, because as something gets big, you know, subsidies can get very big very fast. But also, as renewables scale up, they will become more competitive. We believe that what's happened is that the level of government support for renewables in India and China have been more aggressive than we had previously expected. And that's why we find ourselves revising our forecast higher for those countries. So here's the base underlying data in our narrative scenario on slide 23. On the left-hand side, I'm showing you the regional contributions to the growth of renewables in power generation. And as you can see, historically, it was the green countries that dominated. You know, historically, renewables were a game for the rich countries that could afford the subsidies. Now, however, China has passed the United States to become the biggest producer of renewable energy in the world. Partly that's because China has become richer, partly it's because renewables have become more competitive, and partly it's because China is trying to diversify its fuel mix. In the later years of the outlook, we also see significant contributions from other emerging economies. Now, I began the presentation by showing you that renewables gain market share very rapidly in the world energy mix in this scenario. It is certainly fair to challenge us and say, well, yeah, but aren't you still lowballing it? The point of the chart on the right-hand side is to show you that in this scenario, the pace at which renewables penetrate the global system is without precedent in the historical record of the world's energy system. you know, that renewables gain market share faster than any form of energy historically has gained market share in the world's energy mix. The closest analog is nuclear energy in the 70s and 80s. But, again, we know, let's be humble, we could easily be wrong. So we've examined a scenario that says, well, what if we keep today's aggressive support for renewables throughout the forecast interval? This is what I'm showing you on the left-hand panel of slide 24. In this scenario, more aggressive government support means that instead of getting 50% of the growth of power generation, renewables essentially get 100% of the growth of power generation, with more aggressive government support. The implications of this for the carbon intensity with which global power is produced are shown on the right-hand panel, where I'm showing you, in our narrative scenario, the evolving transition case, the carbon content of the world's power generation falls by about one-third. In the scenario on the far right that's consistent with meeting the Paris commitments, we see a virtual total decarbonization of the power sector. And in between is this push scenario that we're talking about now. One of the things we can observe, however, is diminishing returns. You know, as you push harder and harder to get renewables into the power mix, it becomes more and more expensive to manage with the intermittency and the needs for storage, managing the grid, et cetera. The panel on the far right shows you an opportunity to push, much more successfully in decarbonizing power, but that is not a scenario built only around renewables. Again, if policymakers only push one lever, it's hard to move the whole needle. The scenario on the far right, as we will see in a few slides, also includes scope for gas to push coal out of power generation, or for more efficient use of energy, or for carbon capture and underground storage. And so, again, the systemic wide policy options, have better opportunities to find low-cost solutions for society and to really move the needle at a system level. Next up is natural gas. I mentioned earlier that natural gas is the only fossil fuel that gains market share in the global mix. And as I'm sure you know, we at BP and many other energy companies are investing to grow the role of natural gas in our portfolios. And so a natural question is, well, how could we be wrong on that one? And so, first the base data. On slide 27, I'm showing you the implication or the outlook for gas consumption in this narrative scenario. You can see on the left-hand panel that the growth in natural gas consumption is broadly based around the world. On a sectoral basis, however, on the right-hand side, this is really a two-horse race. It's really a story of growing gas used in power generation and industrial applications. There is a bit more used in transportation, but not at the global gas story, that's not the real driver. Now, another way we can characterize natural gas demand is to think about, well, how much of gas is growing just because everything is growing, and how much is because gas is winning market share from other forms of energy, and in particular from coal in power generation and potentially from oil in transportation. So on slide 28, I show you a rough estimate of that. And the question is, well, what's driving much of that switching, that accounts for half of the growth of natural gas in this scenario? Some of it is economic. Here in the United States, as in the lower 48, cheap shale gas is pushing coal out of power generation. But much of it is driven by policy, in China, for example, as well as in Europe. So we asked ourselves, well, what if policy, largely environmental policy in this case, is not as aggressive as we are assuming in our narrative scenario? What if countries around the world say, maybe we don't need to push so hard after all? It turns out that if we eliminate that policy-driven switching, we would reduce the growth of natural gas demand by about, the growth rate by about half, which may not look like much on the chart on the left-hand panel of 29, but it is the difference between gas gaining market share around the world and losing market share. So from a strategic perspective, it is a significant change. And on the right-hand side, I'm showing you the profile of annual growth of natural gas demand across a range of scenarios. And the key point on the right-hand side is to show you that our narrative scenario is kind of the Goldilocks outcome for natural gas. Yeah, it is the sweet spot. And the key takeaway, as we've just discussed, is that future natural gas demand could fail to materialize in scenarios with both more aggressive environmental policy, where it would lose to renewables, or in scenarios with less aggressive environmental policy, in which case gas fails to gain market share from coal. And so, again, we see that gas is highly sensitive to your assumptions around policy. Next up is one last key point on gas, and I know this is a live issue here in this room and across the state, is the prospects for liquefied natural gas. Here I'm showing you the narrative scenarios profile for gas, liquefied natural gas exports and imports. On the export side, the United States, especially driven by the rapid growth of lower 48 supply, is a big driver of that growth. On the demand side, it's Asia, as always. The reason why we think this rapid growth, in fact, this doubling of global trade in liquefied natural gas is important is because it provides the incentive to the opportunity to more closely link regional gas markets through trade. What we can observe, however, is that, for the lower 48, we do believe that this more flexible LNG trading system, in this reference case to the United States and in particular the lower 48 is well situated to compete, but being on the margin has both risks as well as opportunities. If, for example, China and other Asian consumers don't push as hard to open up their economies to gas, or on the supply side, if the Emirate of Qatar in the Middle East decides to do what we think, OPEC oil producers will do on the oil side, which is grow their market share and be more competitive, both of those things could squeeze the supplier who's at the margin, and we think the lower 48 will be in that position. Let me move to the final question, which is around the energy transition and the move to a lower carbon future. And the answer you've already seen. While we do believe that CO2 emissions will grow less rapidly in the future because energy demand is slowing and because the lower carbon sources of energy, renewables and gas, are the fuels that are gaining market share, we think that the growth rate will slow for CO2 emissions in our narrative scenario, but they still grow. So in this scenario, CO2 emissions grow by about a little over 10%. That's a much slower growth rate than we've seen historically, but again, to actually be on a sustainable trajectory consistent with the Paris commitments, the line would look more like the orange one. Now, what might that mean for the energy sector? If you wanted to get on that orange line toward a more sustainable energy system around the world, I think the answer is, moving to slide 33, if you want to have a serious conversation about CO2, you should begin and end with the power sector, because that, frankly, is the biggest individual source of energy consumption in the world. Over half the world's energy is consumed just to generate electricity. It is also the sector where all the fuels compete with each other, and so the opportunity for finding the low-cost solutions, are most apparent in the power sector. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you what the world's energy demand profile would look like in some different scenarios. And a couple of key points to raise. First, in any scenario, including a scenario that is consistent with meeting the Paris climate objectives, worldwide energy demand grows. Now, in the Paris consistent scenario, what's labeled as EFT, even faster transition, here, all of that growth comes from renewable energy. But notice even there, in a world consistent with moving toward a sustainable trajectory, oil and gas consumption in 2040 is more or less what it is today. So while this is a much more aggressive scenario for the uptake of renewable energy, it is also the case that there is significant space for continued investment in oil and gas, even in a sustainable scenario. Madam's Chair and Honorable Senators, let me just very briefly conclude, and thank you so much for the opportunity to share our perspectives here. Again, we don't do this outlook to predict the future. We do it to understand the risks that we're facing. What dimensions of the energy system do we think we have some confidence in? And what are the key uncertainties that we really need to watch and bear in mind? So I think we can be reasonably comfortable that the world, if we want the world to continue to grow its economy, to continue to lift people out of poverty and improve their quality of lives, that the world's going to need more energy in the future. Now, that growth may slow due to a greater focus on efficiency, but growth nonetheless. At the same time, on the supply side, you know, we do see an emerging age of abundance in terms of a much more competitive dynamic in the oil and gas space and for the world's energy system writ more large. We see that, you know, renewables play a growing role, but even under sustainable climate trajectories, a significant role still for investment in oil and natural gas. In terms of key uncertainties, some of the things that we're watching are the, you know, uncertainties around not only electrification, but the interplay of electrification with other factors like autonomy and ride-sharing services. We've seen very clearly from the data that the future pathways for natural gas and renewable energy are highly dependent on the underlying assumptions you make for policy and technology. You know, and by the way, you know, we've also, you know, music, I'm sure, to the ears of people in this room. You know, we see example after example about how the critical role of policy, you know, in shaping the energy system going forward. And then finally, again, you know, while we see significant progress in, you know, using energy more efficiently and reducing the carbon intensity of energy activity, a much more decisive break from past trends is needed if we were to get the world on a more sustainable trajectory. So with that, let me wrap up. Thank you again for the opportunity, and we certainly have time for more questions and discussion if you do.
Are there questions from members? Senator Stedman? Senator Giesel, any comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Other than as I contemplate this, one of the upsides for Alaska is our significant wealth in minerals, which certainly those renewables will need. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be an off-the-wall question. If so, just let me know. But the recently announced trade tariffs with the United States, with other countries, and China with the United States, does that play a role in your forecast here? Because I would imagine the demand stays the same. It just may come from different regions of the world.
Senator Meyer, through the chair, thank you for the question, and I think it's an entirely appropriate question. I mean, one of the things that we're watching very closely, again, I mentioned earlier, all of these scenarios that we presented today are built around a starting point of success in the sense of continuing to grow the world's economy, continue, you know, lifting 2.5 billion people out of poverty, improving people's quality of life. I think, you know, one of the key risks that we're looking at, you know, that is you know, a greater risk of trade frictions, and both international and domestic policies that could put potential future economic growth at risk. At the end of the day, we consume energy to fuel economic activity, If you can imagine scenarios with higher or weaker economic growth that result from these policy developments, that would go straight to the bottom line of world oil demand. And as we've seen, you know, stock markets and energy markets in recent days reacting to the headlines, you can see exactly what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, you spent a great deal of time thinking about China, the other parts of Asia, India, and their needs. And it's shocking to look at your chart that shows the producing countries versus the importing countries. As a country, we've often underestimated China. Are there energy sources in China that we have not considered? I'm thinking of hydro, renewables, nuclear, shale. Mm-hmm. We're assuming that we're going to keep producing and they're going to keep buying. Is there something else that we need to be aware of?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, thank you. Yes. It's highly uncertain, both the future trajectory of economic growth and therefore energy demand in China. In the last 20 years, China's economy grew by 9 or 10% per year on average for 20 years. We're projecting growth that's maybe more like 4 or 5%. So based on the historical record, there was even faster growth in both the economy and therefore energy demand. I think within China, this reference scenario, this narrative scenario, has very rapid growth of nuclear energy, essentially building one new nuclear reactor every 3 months for the next 20 years. Not so much on hydro because it's the large-scale conventional hydro applications are already developed, basically. China has the biggest growth of renewable energy of any country in the world in this scenario, and yet still has room for significant growth of natural gas, partly because it's still growing and partly because of an effort to displace coal. And in fact, I think we have a chart in the main outlook document that shows today about 30% of the world's energy is consumed in the form of coal. In China, it's more like two-thirds. And they're trying to reduce that share significantly, to diversify their energy mix, but also to clean up local air pollution, air issues, et cetera. So I think the other question, though, from a potential supplier of energy to China's perspective is, what's the competition doing? China is also looking at buying natural gas, from Russia and from, via pipeline from Central Asian republics like Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. There's also, potential competitors of supply of LNG. The Emirate of Qatar for a long time had a moratorium on developing new gas projects, but they're sitting on the biggest gas field in the world, and they recently lifted the moratorium and said, yeah, we're going to invest more. So I think both for you all, it's important to keep an eye on the internal dynamics within China, but also the other eye on, the potential for competition from elsewhere around the world as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members? Mr. Finley, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. Senator Machicki. I
just want to remind members this is one company's view. If you laid other companies' risk assessment and other agencies' risk assessment on the future of energy, could look quite different. There are just concepts in here that are unique. I'm not sure how realistic they are. The ice ban is a fascinating concept. The weight of electrification and ride sharing, I think, is stronger than is probable. And the environmental hypocrisy on the reality of renewables and what that would require as they oppose every option for providing the materials of those renewable technologies. So it's just... I understand the reason for your outlook, and I think it's important to understand the outlying risk. I just want to make sure that as members of finance and resources that have to make some very difficult decision that we don't put too much weight on one particular study.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. We did invite BP to the table this morning and appreciate their sharing their perspective. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good presentation. I thoroughly enjoyed it and actually lifted me up a little bit on one point. What's BP's diversification of their portfolio into renewables?
Mr. Finley.
Senator Bishop, through the chair. Thank you for the questions, and Senator Michie for the comments as well. I think there's a couple of different ways to approach that. As we think about how BP plays into this energy transition, I think the first precept is we want to make sure that we acknowledge that there's a dual challenge. The first challenge is how do we provide the energy that the world needs today to heat your home, get your kids to school, run your business, you know, at the same time, working toward a more sustainable energy system. You know, we have to do both of those at the same time. You know, to kind of straddle that, our strategy is aimed at, you know, we do make sure that our operations are as efficient and safe as possible so that they're up and running all the time, you know, because that's, you know, good business. We make sure that, you know, we continue to invest in oil, but oil that can compete. We've been growing the role of natural gas in our portfolio and renewables. So on renewables, BP has significant investments in wind energy, for example, in the lower 48. We are a significant distributor of biofuels worldwide through, you know, blending into our fuels in our distribution network. We also invest in the production of biofuels in sugarcane ethanol in Brazil. We have a joint venture with one of the leading chemical firms to work on, you know, next-generation biofuels. And we also have significant venture capital activity where we invest seed money in a lot of different potential startup new technologies in both the renewable and more broadly in the energy space, including digital innovation as well, to just kind of watch and learn and see, you know, you sprinkle the money around to kind of see where the landscape is. The other thing that I would add is, you know, we have learned when I joined BP 17 years ago, BP was the largest producer of solar panels in the world. We've learned that just because something is growing rapidly doesn't mean you can make money at it. You know, it has to play to your corporate strengths, and the particulars of the manufacturing of solar cells doesn't or it hasn't historically. So, you know, now more recently BP has invested in a company in the UK that builds and distributes solar systems but doesn't actually build the solar cells themselves. The other thing I would observe is that, and this following example isn't from renewable energy, but I think it's relevant to the conversation, is not only do we have to think about what plays to our strengths, but how can we change ourselves to keep up with the changing world? And the illustration of that is what we've done in the lower 48 with our onshore production unit, you know, having realized that this is a game that is fast-moving and really nimble and really efficient and driven by really world-class operators. BP several years ago legally separated our lower 48 production business, hired a CEO from an independent company, and asked him to try to remake that company into more something that was more nimble and more like an independent company to enable us to compete. You know, and knock wood. So far the results for that have been good too. And so, partly it's what plays to our strengths, and partly is how do we need to change to keep up with the changes in the world around us. So, I gave you the direct answer on renewables, but I wanted to put it into the broader context of how we at BP think about, you know, that as a piece of a broader corporate strategy, and I hope that was helpful.
Senator Bishop.
Yeah, thank you for that. I would just like your opinion. My main takeaway looking at all these slides today, and you showed the diversification of fuel sources and the competition for those fuel sources, that it appears to me as a layman that it's a buyer's market going forward.
Mr. Fenley, comments?
Senator Bishop, through the chair. Yes. I mean, if by buyer you mean, it's a wonderful time. I mean, there's so much change going on. There's still big challenges to be addressed, but within that, we do believe that this is a much more competitive space, and that it is a very much a good news story in the sense that, you know, we conclude across all of these scenarios that the world can have the energy it needs, and the United States can have the energy it needs, and Alaska can have the energy it needs to continue to grow its economy. So, yes, I think in that sense this is, you know, potentially very optimistic and a good news story.
Any further questions? Mr. Fenley, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your comments and your presentation for the people of Alaska.
Madam Chair and the esteemed members of the Senate, thank you very much for the opportunity.
With that, I'd like to announce this afternoon's meeting for Senate Finance will be at 1:30 p.m. We'll be taking up HB 31, which is sexual assault training and exam kits. Under bills previously heard, SB 92, derelict vessels, SB 122, citizen review panel, and should we have the operating budget, HB 286, the operating budget may be read later today. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Senate Resources Committee today is canceled. Thank you.
Anything else to come before the committee? With that, we're adjourned.